loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, at least 33 people died yesterday when Guatemala's Fuego volcano erupted, spewing ash, rock, and gas into the sky just 25 miles from the capital of Guatemala City. It's the country's deadliest volcanic eruption since 1902. Could residents have been better prepared? Next, Jordan's King Abdullah replaced Prime Minister Hani Malki today in an attempt to appease Jordanians who are protesting IMF-backed reforms that have hit the country's poor particularly hard. The government also plans to end taxes that have brought thousands of people into the streets in the capital of Amman. Then we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then we continue our weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits with Chris Garafa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape the world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. And finally, the Yemeni army is on the verge of recapturing the coastal town of Hodeidah, which was taken over by Houthi rebels in 2014. The port's capture would effectively cut off supplies of arms and ammunition to the Houthis, and it would severely limit the Houthis' ability to fire rockets at Saudi Arabia. It was Hodeidah's capture in 2014 that led to the Saudi invasion of Yemen. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first we turn to Guatemala. At least 33 people died yesterday when Guatemala's Fuego volcano erupted, spewing ash, rock, and gas into the sky just 25 miles from the capital of Guatemala City. It's the country's deadliest volcanic eruption since 1902. Could residents have been better prepared? We're joined from Guatemala City, Guatemala by Jackie McVicker. She's a member of the Atlantic Region Solidarity Network, working in solidarity with people struggling for social justice and environmental protection in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Atlantic Canada. And she's a former co-coordinator of the Maritimes Guatemala Breaking the Silence Solidarity Network. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Jackie, tell us why this volcano killed so many people so quickly.
Well, reports are that there was indication that Volcán de Fuego, or the fire volcano, would be erupting. It's hard, I think, to predict the magnitude of such an eruption. But the national organization that's supposed, the institute that's supposed to be monitoring the volcanoes and emergency preparedness for the country, there are reports that actually they told people that although they knew that there would be an eruption, that people were not evacuated. So yesterday morning, before this happened, people in local communities nearby were not evacuated. And so the type of volcano eruption that happened here isn't a low kind of steady fire. It's a huge blast. So basically it was a huge blast of gas and debris that was traveling at very high speeds. That's what essentially buried people alive. That gas is what killed people. And the only way that it wasn't possible for people to leave following the eruption, it was immediate. I mean, it killed people and buried people immediately. So the unpreparedness of the state, of the institutions that are supposed to be monitoring and helping people be prepared, were not giving the accurate information. And this led to, I think, much more casualties than needed to happen.
You know, one of the characteristic features, and I want to ask Jackie about it, in Guatemala is an extremely underdeveloped infrastructure. It's considered by, I'm looking at something called National Nations Encyclopedia, and they say an underdeveloped infrastructure is one of the main obstacles to investment and economic development in Guatemala. Well, it's also the main problem, really, in terms of helping people survive natural disasters. You look at countries that have a developed infrastructure and a developed system to deal with national emergencies and natural disasters. You know, even you compare Cuba to Haiti, for instance. Cuba has a lot of hurricanes. Almost no one dies because there's a plan. about how people are going to be evacuated, how they're going to get to, how they are they going to evacuate, the roads they're going to take, the shelters they're going to stay in. It's planned. In the case of Guatemala, in Haiti, by the way, just the opposite. You know, even a small earthquake could kill tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about why Guatemala's infrastructure is so underdeveloped, because in some ways, Jackie, it must be also the consequence of perhaps the worst kinds of colonialism. Just talk about why this is.
Yeah, I mean, communities and people that were mostly affected are living on the south coast. So you can see historically, this is an area that's been completely, I would say, devastated. So resources like water that have been basically stolen by large sugarcane plantations that are occupying and have historically evicted people from their homelands to make way for agribusiness. So you have an area that's huge extensions of land. You'll see sugarcane fields and fields, and then you have literally hundreds of thousands of people living in very, very, very small areas. So the density population is extremely high in the area where the volcano erupted and where the gas and was flowing. So partly, you know, you have people living in really dire living situation. So, you know, a lot of the pictures that you're seeing are, you know, people living in very, very humble homes of, you know, wood with tin roofs, dirt floors, people not knowing what even to do in a state of emergency, like you said. So when there is an alert, where to go, what to do about it. There were people who just decided to stay in their homes because they didn't know what was happening, who were essentially buried alive because of that. So historically, these are people, many indigenous people who live on the south coast who have been forced to work in the sugar plantations. You have people that are also migrants, workers, a lot of people who stay for a while and then have to leave or are from other areas of the country but who come down for the sugar harvest. You also have a lot of people who have come to that area in particular who are working in foreign sweatshops or maquilas, as they're called. So people who are living in precarious situations because of their precarious work situations are living there. So you have just a really high, high density of people in living within a community where there is no emergency preparedness, where basically the state has forgotten about people living here. Access to basic services are probably minimal. And of course, that's the part of the history of colonization and that history that continues. I mean, if you look and see the amount of support, you know, some of the big agribusinesses are receiving, how much they get, how little, I should say, they actually pay in taxes. And so when the state of Guatemala, President Morales has been, there's a quote that he actually said a few months ago, but it's been kind of retweeted and going around social media, him saying that the state doesn't have a dime to spend on emergency preparedness. And at the same time, we have companies like the ones that are working on the South Coast that are essentially stealing water, that are stealing land and aren't paying taxes. And so you have no money, but you have no willingness by a state to try and enact any kind of support for communities that would need it.
We're speaking from Guatemala City, Guatemala, with Jackie McVicker. She is a member of the Atlantic Region Solidarity Network. We're talking about the terrible death toll and suffering in Guatemala from the volcano. You're in a courthouse, Jackie, where you are. I want you to talk about that. People may not know that the U.S. government helped overthrow the democratically elected government of Arbenz in 1954 when it tried to limit the power of U.S. transnational corporations. And then between 1960 and I think 1996, a war in Guatemala that took the lives of tens of thousands of people that the U.S. was also deeply involved in. Where are you? What's going on? And talk about that war.
I'm in the Guatemala Supreme Court of Justice. I'm in a high-risk courtroom where a judge is hearing. It's the second day of a first hearing against six men who have been charged with rape and war crimes from 1981 till 1985 in the region of Guatemala called Rabinal, where there was systemic violence perpetrated against Maya Achi, indigenous Maya Achi people. And in particular, this case is 36 women who were detained both in their homes after massacres. So many massacres happened where the men were killed, and as a result of or as a consequence following that, a lot of women were then sexually assaulted, raped, their homes were burned down, all of their belongings stolen. And so today I'm in this courtroom listening to some of the pretrial evidence be shared of some of the survivors of that aggression, and waiting to see if these six men who were part of what was called the Civil Defense Patrollers, that was basically a form of controlling civil populations by the state. So they organized men into civil defense groups who were then responsible for basically being spies on their community and for carrying out atrocious crimes. And so these are some of the material authors, but the hope is that there will eventually be also a hearing against some of the intellectual authors, military intelligence, and military high command that were in power during the time of the genocide in Rabinow.
Genocide, that's what it was. John Kiriakou, the Reagan administration was neck deep in it, along with the U.S. intelligence agencies and the Pentagon.
And no one ever paid a price.
Yeah. Complete impunity.
Well, we're out of time. We were joined from Guatemala City, Guatemala by Jackie McVicker. Jackie's a member of the Atlantic Region Solidarity Network, working in solidarity with people struggling for social justice and environmental protection in Latin America, the Caribbean, and Atlantic Canada. And she's a former co-coordinator of the Maritimes Guatemala Breaking the Silence Solidarity Network. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Jordan's King Abdullah replaced Prime Minister Hani Malki today in an attempt to appease Jordanians who are protesting IMF-backed reforms that have hit the country's poor particularly hard. The government also plans to end taxes that have brought thousands of people into the streets in the capital of Amman. We're joined from Amman by Daoud Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Daoud, welcome.
Thank you.
Daoud, this seems different from so many of the other demonstrations that we've seen across the Middle East in the last 7 years or so. This one, we've already seen governmental action by removing Hani Malki as prime minister. Now, it's not unusual for Jordanians to have a short-lived prime minister. They're replaced relatively frequently, but would you say that this is the government responding positively so far to the demands of protesters?
I think this is a sign that the king has been responsive to the protest of the young people. But I'm not sure the introduction you gave to this segment is correct. I'm not sure that this IMF-inspired income tax law really does affect the poor. I'm not sure also that the recent experience with Jordan has been that governments are short-lived. In fact, this particular income tax law affects more the middle class and the professional sector than the poor. And the King Abdullah has tried in the last three rounds to keep the governments much longer than his father did. So, but in general, yes, the population or the younger people have exploded in protests throughout the country. There have been peaceful demonstrations, and the police has been extremely disciplined in dealing with them, and that, I think, is a good sign. But yes, people are not happy with the income tax law.
How did this thing start in the first place?
Well, it began last Wednesday. The professional unions, which is quite strong here in Jordan, declared a one-day strike And the next day, which was the end of the month, the government-appointed committee, which decides the rate of the fuel, decided because the price of fuel worldwide has gone up, they raised the price of the fuel. So these two kind of events happened back to back, and people just exploded in demonstrations throughout the country. And the king tried to intervene by delaying the hike of the fuel. But by that time, the Pandora's box had been opened, and people started demonstrating. It kind of helps that it's Ramadan, and in Ramadan, people, after they eat they break their fast, they normally go out and walk in the streets and kind of, you know, enjoy themselves. And so this became almost a kind of a picnic thing. The government police is not breaking up the demonstrations, and there's lots of young people who have nothing else to do. And so it became kind of a trendy thing to do, and everybody went out. What's interesting, actually, this time is that some of the leaders seemed to have matured from the last round of the Arab Spring, and they were much more careful in presenting reasonable demands. They're not trying to go for too much in the demand structure and changing the entire structure. Just they're pressing the need for a change in the income tax law.
You know, I wanted to point out too that these demonstrations seem different from the demonstrations that we've seen elsewhere around the region, because many of them so far have been led by professionals, by engineers and lawyers and teachers, rather than by youths. We're not seeing, for example, people throwing stones. We're not seeing, as you pointed out, people challenging the police. There have only been a handful of arrests, very, very few injuries on either side. This just seems different to me.
It is. And as you said, I mean, I did a profile in Arab News Today about the age group. They're about 25 to 35. Many of them are workers, employees, educated people. And lots of women are out demonstrating, and the men are not harassing as normally happens. There is actually they're creating a chain so that nobody, you know, bothers the women who are participating. And some women are actually cheering and leading some of the demonstrations. So it's quite different. It's quite mature, if you will. And you're right, because it is in the professional level that are hit the most by this new income tax law, that you're seeing quite a different level of people who are demonstrating and protesting.
I'd like to just ask you a little bit more about that, Dawood. In terms of the political character of some of these professional unions, I was in Amman a couple times in the late 1990s and mid-1990s with Ramsey Clark, because we were bringing a donated medicine from the United States in violation of the economic sanctions on Iraq. And we were coming through Amman, and we were frequently hosted by some of the professional unions, including, I think, the doctors and lawyers. They seem to be very politically progressive. How do you characterize these groups?
They are. I mean, the unions have always been much further ahead than the parliament. We really don't have much of a party system here. And so the activists are often active in the professional unions. And you've had a lot of Baathists and leftists and, you know, communists. And, of course, in recent years, Islamic movements have also won many of these professional unions. It's interesting, last month the Engineers Union, for the first time in 23 years, overtook the Engineers Union from the Islamists to a kind of a coalition of leftists and other progressives. So yes, it's quite normal for the unions to be run by people who have very high ideological backgrounds. Often, many of them had in the past been in prison, and so they've often acted as the real opposition in the country.
And again, just so for our Washington audience or our American audience that may not know much about Jordan and its demographics, if this had been taking place, say these kind of events, say, I don't know, 45 or 50 years ago, say around the time of 1970. They would undoubtedly have been dominated by the left-wing parties of the Palestinian movement, because, of course, a big part of the population in Jordan is Palestinian. What's the demographic basis of this, if there is one?
It's actually quite interesting that we have not really seen any signals that the people who are involved have not really revealed their kind of national identity or ideological identity. In fact, there's been a decision that nobody raises any flags other than Jordanian flags, and no kind of ideological or parties raise their flags. Most of the people are just young activists that some of them have never been involved in politics. And I think the Palestinian-Jordanian divide really didn't appear. And some people are saying that thank you to the IMF that actually united Jordanians and Palestinians against the IMF in a funny way. But really, there has been absolutely no discernible signaling of any kind of an ideological or ethnic background to the people involved, because it really has affected the entire sector of professional people.
You know, the IMF always has one solution to any economic problems, which is to...
I was going to say the same thing.
Okay, so we have ESP here. It's always austerity for some segment of the working population.
And causes nothing but misery.
You know, the IMF is, that's their business. They give loans and they don't have any solutions other than austerity one. The fact is that the people are quite upset, and the IMF... for their side, say, look, we didn't decide it was your country that actually we put conditions in the sense that you have to show us your plan, how you're going to raise the money. But it's really what I often call it, this IMF-inspired conditions rather than IMF-imposed conditions. But nevertheless, it's the same. You don't get the money unless you do these things.
They're going to repeal this tax law either way.
The tax law actually hasn't passed.
Oh, it hasn't even passed.
No, the government approved it, sent it to Parliament, and Parliament is not in session. And one of the reasons why there is demonstration, the professional unions come in, is they don't trust the Parliament. The Parliament is mostly a kind of rubber stamp for the government, and so they basically want the government to withdraw the draft law, and because they know that if it reaches the Parliament, you know, the government can easily buy off some of the key members, and then they will all vote for it. And so that's where the protest began, because the professional unions know very well that Parliament is not that independent.
I think the American people need to learn from the Jordanians. If you're looking to Parliament, or in our case Congress, nothing's going to happen. But it can happen if people go to the streets.
True.
It's been an awakening and a really nice experience that people are understanding that, you know, young people especially who rarely vote and rarely participate in political life realize when it hits their pocket that they better move. Otherwise, you know, the few elitists, so-called elitists, will decide for them what's going to happen.
That was the voice of Daoud Kutab. He joined us from Amman, Jordan. Daoud is an award-winning Palestinian journalist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
We continue today our weekly segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education around the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, a Radical Manifesto. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, welcome back.
Good to hear from you.
Bill, we were talking on this show last week about closures, school closures in Puerto Rico, and the damage that these closures were doing to the island's education. The same thing is going on in Chicago, and the powers that be want people to think that closing schools makes the community better, makes the community stronger. Tell us about what's going on in the Chicago schools.
Well, it's interesting because the link you're making between Chicago and national policy and Puerto Rico, I think, is a very important one for people to understand. In Chicago in 2013, you might remember Mayor Rahm Emanuel, a Democrat in a Democratic city in a Democratic state, closed 50-plus schools, mostly in African-American communities. And they did this after they had all the public relations of a listening tour where the superintendent, the CEO, who's now in prison for corruption, and others went around and listened to the neighborhoods. The outcry was intense and unanimous. Do not close our schools. Please don't close our schools. But they closed 50 plus schools anyway. Now, all these years later, comes a report from the University of Chicago, who did some deep research on the problem and discovered that not only did closing schools create further blight in under-resourced neighborhoods and contribute to a black exodus, which is a very shameful part of Chicago and also links to Puerto Rico, where we're going to talk about the exodus there, but it also resulted in a drop in test scores of the affected kids. 12,000, mostly African-American kids, were impacted by this. And what they discover in this research, what they highlight, is that closing schools, even poorly performing schools, does not improve the outcomes for children at all. And closing under-enrolled schools only seems like a viable solution to the bean counters, to the businessmen, to the policymakers who are thinking in terms of deficits and so on. But the reality is that closing schools causes huge disruption for the neighborhood, for the kids and families involved. And to link it to Puerto Rico, you're bringing Puerto Rico up. You know, they closed something like 160 plus schools a year ago. And then when the hurricane struck, they closed 265 more schools. I think that's a third of the schools in Puerto Rico. Once again, disrupting these kids' lives, destroying neighborhoods, and forcing a migration away from Puerto Rico to New York, to Miami, and elsewhere. So this is a policy that people who see schools clearly said is going to be a catastrophe. Now, years later, it's proven to be a catastrophe. And what's the response of power? The current CEO, Janice Jackson in Chicago, says, oh, that was unacceptable. And when asked if she would close schools in the future, she said, maybe. So, I mean, it's just outrageous. It's a classic kind of listening only to yourself and never actually using evidence to try to understand what's really going on if you really cared about people.
You know, Bill, I want to ask you if there's sort of an intertangling here of a critique of public education, an assault on public education, the closing of schools, with other larger sort of social engineering projects. In the case of Puerto Rico, as you mentioned, and as John, you and I discussed last week with people from Puerto Rico, 260 more schools closed. If families don't have access to schools, if the schools become harder and harder to get to, or if the schools are just a terrible mess, if that's part of the sort of decision-making process, at the same time they're facing high rents or lack of access to services, they move. And then other people come in and move where they used to live. And, you know, we know that now as gentrification.
That's right.
And we also see in the case of Puerto Rico, very prized real estate, beautiful island in the middle of the Caribbean, a U.S. colony, but meaning that people who live there have U.S. citizenship. It seems like Puerto Rican activists feel like this is a vast relocation effort, a gentrification of an island. Is the same thing going on in black communities in the case of the South Side of Chicago, for instance, Bill?
You know, in Chicago, we have a national scandal happening, which is the outflow of the black population. And yet the population overall in Chicago is not going down. It's pretty much stable. A headline in a business Crane Chicago Business last week said, if you've noticed more bright young people in Chicago, your observation is correct. And if you change the word bright to white, you're seeing exactly what's happening. The out-migration of black working class and poor people and the in-migration of young people, very much what happened in New Orleans, young white people, New Orleans. And yes, you're right about Puerto Rico. And part of the problem I think we face, and this is something we've talked about before, is the framing of the issue. What is the problem? What are we talking about? So we can get seduced into terms like, well, the schools are underutilized. What does underutilized even mean in a place like Chicago? Here's a school in a neighborhood. If education is a human right, these kids have a right to access to that school. But no, it's underutilized. Now, that means that the class size has dropped to something like, you know, below 25 or something. And yet the powerful people in this city send their kids to schools where the class size is 12. Nobody says the University of Chicago Lab School is underutilized. It's just a sensible setup. So be careful of those kind of words. Similarly, be careful of the kind of framing or choices that were allowed. For example, when you talk about gentrification, I was in a forum the other day with some housing activists, and one liberal politician said, yeah, but what's better, a blighted neighborhood or a gentrified neighborhood? And of course, the housing activists immediately said, that's not the choice. That's not the choice between whether we have to move people out or accept the fact that there are no resources and that housing stock is being degraded. No, we could have a choice to build housing for homeless people, to improve housing and services to poor people, but that's a political choice. It's not a sociological fact that poor people have to be ghettoized and screwed. That's a political choice that we can relook at and make differently.
Yeah, I mean, we can see this in Washington, D.C. There's absolutely massive gentrification going on. You know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, the city was about 70% African American. Now, and this is such a short time span, less than 50% African American, and that trend is continuing dynamically. And the people who are fighting for to keep affordable housing, and there's like all these kind of struggles going on all over the place. And it's the same people who are fighting for education, fighting for housing, and their families who are living in these communities. They're saying, look, it's not that we don't want an improvement of social services or private businesses in our area, but the choice that's being presented is, in order for those things to happen, we, the people who have lived here for, in some cases, more than a century, must leave. The precondition for improvement is that Black working class folks have to be vacated from these areas. And all kinds of tactics are being employed to do just that.
Well, exactly. And one of those tactics is the closing of schools. And it has to be resisted. It is being resisted. But you're absolutely right to tie all these issues together and to remind ourselves that in a place like Chicago or Washington or the United States of America, what we need is a social movement that links the issues of housing and education and employment and anti-discrimination and police under civilian control and so on and so on, so that we understand that a living, vibrant community is quite possible, but it's not possible if we allow the 1% and the austerity hawks to run our politics. And we have to resist that with everything we have. And the best way to resist it is to begin to see these social movements, these movements for quality education, movement for fair housing, movement for Medicare for all or for universal health care, minimum wage movement. All these things in Chicago are coming together. And if we can find a way to really bring ourselves together under a common program, I think we're irresistible.
Bill, we've got under 2 minutes left. I want to switch real quickly to Texas. There's a plan that Governor Greg Abbott has proposed to the state legislature relative to school safety. Now, Abbott made a fool of himself recently by saying after the shooting in outside of Houston that what schools need is just one entry and exit. That was his solution. What is this plan about, and does it have any chance in the legislature?
Well, I think it has a chance, but I think that what we're looking at when we see right-wing Republican governors and legislatures talk about school safety, they're trying to avoid the elephant in the room. They're trying to avoid the very question that would bring safety to our schools. And that's got to do with more than gun control, honestly. It has to do with what kind of relationships do you build in these schools? What kind of education do we have? And one of the things that we're seeing again and again is the stripping of the arts, the stripping of extracurricular activities, the stripping away of sports, and kind of a fierce concentration on drill and kill. And we're looking at the kind of deprofessionalization of educators, so that instead of imagining teachers building community with children, where we're actually in communication with one another, actually know what's going on with one another, there's this kind of deep alienation, giant high schools, very, very few opportunities to express oneself and to build a real education. And the solution that these folks come up with is always a military solution, a criminal justice solution. And that is not the solution that we need in schools.
That was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill is an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. He joined us from Chicago. And you can check out his important work at www.billayers.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits with Chris Garaffa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape our world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey guys, happy Monday.
Chris, I want to start with this news from Google. Gizmodo's been following it, and even Rolling Stone has been following it, the mainstream media. Tell us what's going on with Google and the Pentagon.
Sure. So people might remember a few months ago that there was a mass letter signed by over 3,000 Google employees objecting to something called Project Maven. And what Maven was a partnership with the Department of Defense and the Pentagon to analyze drone footage. And Google would provide the software and the technology to use artificial intelligence to analyze drone footage and see what exactly was in that footage. The initial report said it would be only used with unarmed drones, but privacy experts and anti-war experts saw very clearly that this could escalate to using AI and Google providing those services to use drones even more than they're used now, and to automate the process of using drones to target people overseas or possibly even in the U.S. So what Google announced was that they're actually not going to be continuing Project Maven. Over a dozen employees had also resigned in protest over the course of a couple of weeks. Google said that they're not going to pursue Maven because, quote, the backlash has been terrible for the company, but that doesn't even, you know, mesh with their former motto, which was don't be evil.
Mm-hmm. There were some internal emails that...
Did they have to drop that?
You know what? They did drop that.
Yeah.
They actually did a couple of weeks ago. They took it out of the employee handbook.
Just some evil now? I mean, like, what's the new...
Well, interestingly enough, Google executives said publicly that this contract was very small and it wasn't really important to the financial health of the company. But then internal emails that were leaked to Gizmodo said that, on the contrary, executives saw this as a golden opportunity to win billions of dollars in new business from the Pentagon.
Yeah, and that has to be part of it, right, Chris? And it's really something that these Google employees have taken the initiative, because once you're in the military-industrial complex, once you're part of the team, given the fact that the U.S. government has limitless funding for everything, and of course it's always for national security, it's always to keep the country and the people safe, that's just a vast sort of limitless horizon of more funding.
That's right. You know, being also an anti-war activist myself, you know, we know that the one budget that never gets cut is the so-called national defense budget. And that's, you know, certainly not even the right name for it. It's the offense budget, the military budget.
The war budget.
The war budget, exactly. Thank you, Brian. And what this means is that Google wanted to just make more money, make significant profit off of the wars. And we see the Pentagon deploying all over the world into new areas, particularly Southeast Asia, with everything going on with China and Korea. And that was, Google was seeing an opportunity there because they are a business. They want to make money. They're concerned mostly about, primarily about their profit. And they want to make the money off of the Pentagon contracts. We should note, too, they already do work with the NSA and other intelligence agencies, as we learned from Edward Snowden.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Sure. We know that Google is a partner in PRISM, or was a partner in PRISM and in other programs. Edward Snowden was the most famous to leak this, but there have been other whistleblowers. And Google provides information and is considered a partner to the NSA and the CIA regarding recording and providing information, not just metadata, but actual data about our searches, about our contacts, our everything we do online, effectively. They track so much information for the purpose of targeting advertisements to us, and they are more than happy to share that. And it's not just Google, it's dozens and hundreds of other companies. They're more than happy to share that with the NSA and others.
Yeah, so PRISM is the is the NSA program where that collects and stores internet communications based on demands made to internet companies by the National Security Agency. Again, an agency with a vast budget, but also a secret budget.
That's right. We don't know what the NSA's budget is. We don't know certainly what it's used for until these leaks come out. And again, we should all be thankful to Edward Snowden still for that.
Yeah. And of course, Edward Snowden, if he were having done this great service, if he were actually to show up here in the United States,
yep.
Same with Julian Assange, he would be immediately arrested, no doubt, face the rest of his life in prison. Last November, it was announced that Amazon was launching a secret cloud service for the CIA. Amazon, Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post that writes all these stories about this, that, and the other thing. Amazon owns the Washington Post. It has a $600 million contract with the CIA. Amazon Web Services introduced Secret Region, a new service specifically for the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community. I love the term community. It sounds kind of like a kumbaya thing.
Right,
let's get all these like intelligence spies, our community together, and we can do Amazon things. Anyway, it's the name indicates it can handle data that's been classified at the, quote, secret level. This is the trend, Chris. This is the trend. You have private corporations, presumably representing that entrepreneurial spirit of American, free market capitalism, but in fact, mega monopolies like Google, like Amazon, working hand in glove with the CIA, the NSA, the Pentagon. They have some differences, but they're basically collaborators.
They are. They are collaborators. And as Chris just said a moment ago, without whistleblowers like Ed Snowden, we wouldn't even have any idea that this was taking place, that there are these multi-billion dollar contracts between the CIA, the Pentagon, and Amazon and Google and other, Fortune 500 information companies.
Yeah, before Snowden, we have people like James Clapper telling the Congress, absolutely doesn't exist. This program doesn't exist. Then Snowden's revelations make it clear it does exist. And then these officials like Clapper say, well, I made the least untrue statement I could possibly make under the circumstances, also known as perjury.
That's right.
Chris Garofa, let's move on to Facebook.
Yeah, there was a huge story that came out yesterday in the New York Times that effectively says that over the last decade, Facebook worked directly with Apple and BlackBerry and Samsung and 60 other device makers, mobile phone makers, to partner with them to give access directly to these device makers to our private data that we share on Facebook, or what should be our private data. In many cases, these integrations ignored our privacy settings and, in fact, ignored our friends' privacy settings as well. And this goes back, this isn't just a 2016, 2018 thing. This goes back at least a decade. Now, Facebook obviously got very defensive and put a statement out saying that this was in the best interest of its users, but it's not in the best interest of Facebook users like you and me to put out and to share information with companies that we're not even aware of. It's in our best interest to keep that information private. So that really shows the hypocrisy of Facebook when they effectively are a data company masquerading as a social network.
And how many times is Mark Zuckerberg going to have to come out and say, after telling everybody this was in the interests of Facebook's users, how many times is he going to have to come out and say he's sorry, that was wrong, and they won't do it again, and then say disingenuously that they didn't make any money doing it in the first place?
Yeah, he'll say, again, he hurt our community.
Right.
The community, of course, is just a data collection operation. Go ahead, Chris.
And in this case, they haven't even said they're sorry. If you look at the post on Facebook's blog that they put out yesterday, it is very, very defensive. They just claim the New York Times got it all wrong, that this was in the best interest of Facebook users. The really scary part about this is not just that Facebook gave this access, is that we don't know. First of all, 60 device manufacturers. I don't think I know anyone who can name 60 companies that make cell phones.
Apple, Amazon, BlackBerry, Microsoft, Samsung, those are six. Who are the other 54?
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. What were those companies doing with this data? We don't know. We don't know where it was going. Now, of course, BlackBerry and Samsung and Microsoft say, first of all, that they're weaning themselves away from this partnership in favor of other integrations, and that they never gave the data away. I don't see how we can trust that just because they're saying it, which if we've learned one thing over the past decade, we can't trust what these technology companies say they're doing with our data. But who are these other 60 companies?
Yeah, we don't know. We only have a minute left, just under a minute left.
We named six. We're just down 54.
But I want to go on to another Facebook issue, and that was a report that Facebook forbids. It's entitled "Facebook Forbids White Supremacy but Allows White Nationalism." Leaked documents show. What's that all about?
Goering, not Hitler.
Right. So effectively, Facebook's community policies, which were leaked, these are the policies that Facebook's community team use when they're reviewing what you're reporting on Facebook. If you're reporting a post or a page or a comment, they forbid explicit white supremacy, but white nationalism is entirely okay with them. It's okay to say the white race is to call for a white nation in the United States without, you know, Facebook doesn't think that that's an issue.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Well, we're out of time.
It's called the better Nazis.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to try to convince people of that.
Yeah.
Aren't they?
The good Nazis.
We're out of time. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. We'll talk to him again next week. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Yemeni army is on the verge of recapturing the coastal town of Hodeidah, which was taken over by Houthi rebels in 2014. The port's capture would effectively cut off supplies of arms and ammunition to the Houthis, and it would severely limit the Houthis' ability to fire rockets at Saudi Arabia. It was Hodeidah's capture in 2014 that led to the Saudi invasion of Yemen. We're joined from London by Catherine Shakdam. She's a political commentator and analyst focusing on the Middle East, and she's also the author of A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Catherine, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Catherine, tell us, is this recapture by the Yemeni army of Hodeidah a good thing for Yemen or a bad thing for Yemen?
Well, it really depends how you look at it. But the problem that we face right now is a humanitarian issue. And has to do with the fact that the Saudi are threatening to completely level the seaport of Hodeidah, which means that, as you mentioned it earlier, the only humanitarian corridor that the north of Yemen has would be completely cut off. And that means condemning people to starvation, millions of people to starvation, bearing in mind that those very people have already suffered, you know, several years of a very taxing war. From a humanitarian perspective, because they have been bombed, they have been starved, medicine is not coming, food is not coming, nothing is coming through. So to now condemn them just for the sake of scoring, I think more of a political point than a military one, to condemn them to death, I'm not sure whether it's justifiable or even rational. We can't really rationalize this. Now, from a really military standpoint, yes, the seaport of Hodeidah is absolutely crucial. And that would mean that whoever controls it would severely threaten the resistance movement standing. But now as to the future of Yemen, I don't know how it's going to play out because, as usual, we never actually ask the people of Yemen how, you know, they want this conflict to be resolved because nobody is willing to go and sit, you know, around a table to try to discuss the future. And that's a problem. So it's not so much the case of who's to gain. It's more to, you know, the question should be who has more to lose. And the people of Yemen are the one losing right now. So I don't know how you can say whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It really depends on which side of the table you're sitting. I choose to, you know, go with the people. So I don't really care who holds the ports of Hodeidah, just as long as the people don't get to suffer. And just as long as, you know, whoever will hold the port will manage to secure, you know, a humanitarian corridor for the people. Because ultimately, I'd like to think that people's lives matter more than, again, scoring political points or, you know, granting a military victory to the Saudis. Because right now, this is all that seems to matter to the international community and, of course, Saudi Arabia.
Oh, you've made so many important points just in the last minute or so. Let's start by talking about humanitarian relief. There's a major port, of course, in Aden in South Yemen that has been completely closed off. And as a result, people are starving. There's no clean water. People are dying of dysentery and other preventable diseases. Medicines can't get in. And And how else are Yemenis supposed to get relief supplies? Is there any other way besides Hodeidah?
No, of course not. Because, I mean, remember, I mean, Sana'a Airport has been pummeled so many times that I don't think you could figure out where the airport used to stand, because it's a crater right now. You know, there is nothing that is coming through. And so the Saudi are quite literally now systematically going after the only routes that people have, you know, to get food in. And so you have to ask yourself the question, is it because they're trying to end this war, or is it because they're trying to impose maximum damage and suffering onto the people of Yemen? And I'm going for the latter, and that's the problem, because systematically civilians have been targeted, so that, you know, the Saudi are hoping that by you know, very heavily leaning on people's ability to survive, then, you know, they would rebel against the resistance movement and precipitate the fall of, you know, the Houthi and other factions who do support the Houthi. But again, I don't think that we can justify this. I don't think that we should stand for this, because the point and the matter is the people of Yemen deserve to have a future that is their own. And that means that we have to accompany them as they try to formulate a way out of this war and decide what political future they will have. But we're not doing this. What we're doing is allowing the Saudi to continue, again, to justify, you know, the death of civilians, the starvation of children, the prevention, you know, diseases are, you know, just damaging so many villages and ravaging so many lives, just for the sake of political game and geopolitical standing. How can you ever justify this? And to justify, again, the destruction of a seaport, because you're alleging that it's gonna impair the enemies, the so-called enemies, the resistance movement ability to survive. I'm sorry, but I'm not having it, because at the end of the day, collateral damages are so grave that we cannot justify. It's not, you cannot say that it's okay to condemn millions of people to death by starvation, you know, and dying from horrible diseases which are preventable, just because the Saudi decided a few years back that it was a bad idea, you know, to have the Houthi have a place at the political table of Yemen. This is not right. And I don't care what people think of the Houthi at this point. We have to abide by the rule of law and international law. And I'm sorry, but I don't think that genocide is ever justifiable to score political points.
The United Nations has a special envoy for Yemen. His name is Martin Griffiths, and he arrived in Sana'a yesterday to speak first with the Houthis. And then with the government, he's going to Hodeidah to continue those talks. Can you tell us about these talks and about what the UN's role in Yemen is? And do you expect anything positive to come out of this?
I don't think so, because, I mean, so far, nothing has ever happened, because the UN is not being an impartial party here. The UN is actually leaning on the side of Saudi Arabia, trying to dictate. I mean, what they're trying to do is dictate the tone that the Saudi has set, and lean heavily on the resistance and trying to tell them, well, you know, if you want the war to be done and if you want to stop suffering, then you're going to have to just give up, again, a seat at the table and give up the right to actually have a voice in Yemen's political future. And, you know, regardless of what one may think of the Houthi and those factions who do support them, it's not right. If we're talking about democracy and pluralism, then those people need to have a seat at the table. Now, it's, you know, it's only fair to give them a chance to actually tell the people what it is that they want and to see whether people will grant them support. Otherwise, we can't talk about a real democracy. So the UN right now is just pushing a Saudi agenda. It's not even pushing a humanitarian agenda, because this I think that we could get behind, but they're not. All they're doing is basically trying to sell the Saudi agenda to the resistance movement, maybe by using, you know, nicer words, or maybe by, you know, promising, you know, money, or God knows what they're promising, but it's not leading to anything. And at the end of the day, people are still suffering. Nobody seems to care. Nobody seems to see the emergency and the need to actually broker a truce here, so that, you know, people could stop dying. We could open a humanitarian corridor, make sure that people, you know, are given the aid that they need, and then maybe go back to the table and discuss, you know, a way out of this war. Nobody seems to be interested. And least of all Saudi Arabia, because whenever we have tried, the Houthi have tried to come up with, you know, an agenda to actually to begin to discuss certain things, the Saudi have shut down the show, said, no, absolutely not. You need to do this and this and this, knowing fully well that those conditions that they were putting were not acceptable at all, and that, you know, the peace talks will completely fail. This is what they have done systematically. This is not how you conduct a negotiation. You have to give and take a little bit to be able to at least sit down together without, you know, bashing each other's head. But the Saudi are not interested, and the UN is backing the Saudi. Therefore, we're going nowhere.
Talk about the military situation for a minute. So the Yemeni army is taking Hodeidah today. Is this a one-shot deal, or does this presage some kind of grander movement by the army against the Houthis? That's a long way of saying, is this going to shorten the war in any way?
I don't think so. I think the problem is because now, you know, the Yemeni, when you say the Yemeni army, it's actually, you know, a return of the Saleh clan that you're witnessing on the ground. And I think that what is happening here is that we forgot, you know, when we were talking about Yemen, that, you know, we said that Saleh was gone because, you know, he resigned. But you need to understand that he has immense still power and pull in Yemen, especially in the military. You see this today. And so, you know, his family is kind of using this as a way to, you know, have their voices back and to be able to, you know, support their own political agenda, because they still have, again, big traction within Al-Mu'tamar, the General People's Congress. And so I think that what you see is actually a split, another split in Yemen, another, you know, an additional layer to this issue. You know, whereas before, when Saleh was still alive, the former president, then we had a shot at some kind of a coalition. Now, this has disappeared because he has been assassinated. And so now, you know, what the resistance bloc has been split. And so now there's so many different factions with so many different agenda that it's so very difficult to imagine a truce or even a peace now, because how do you mend those bridges that have been burned down completely? The Saudi made sure of that. So it's complicated.
I can't even imagine getting all those different factions around the same table. There wouldn't even be room for them all. We're going to have to leave it there, Catherine. We were joined from London by Catherine Shakdam, a political commentator and analyst focusing on the Middle East, and the author of A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and now at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.